I never got that kind of welcome when I go in somebody's house to fix their toilet. Okay. Some of them are pretty happy, though, when it's coming down through the ceiling and everything. Of course, I never had them all together, you know. My name's Jack Dempsey, and I'm a drunk, not a fighter. How you doing, folks? Hi. It's really amazing to me that I'm at something like this, you know. It surprises me that I'm sober. You know, I've been sober. I noticed down here you say how when you got sober, you give your date. Well, I had my last drink April the 18th, 1970. That was right after God assigned Clancy to Pittsburgh for a weekend or something. To clean up the wreckage of the old timers in Pittsburgh. Jesus. You know, I got this story about me, you know, and I tell it, and I like to say up at home, you know, I lead a lot of meetings, and sometimes you get on a kick where you're leading meetings around the same area, and the same people were there all the time, you know, I'd rather not be like that. You know, I love it to talk to a lot of people, and I don't think that has anything to do with lack of humility. It's just the odds that somebody out there like you is better, you know? But I tell them people at home, I say, you know, if you heard my lead or heard one like it and don't like it, you know, just look at my position. I lead a lot, and I heard me every time, you know, so the other people that suffer with that, they just got to suffer with it. Or if you suffer with the same kind of speaker, that's the reason I brought that up. I was talking to my wife about it. I said, Jesus, I identified so much with all these speakers. You know, this is going to be like the plumber's version of what you already heard. You know what I mean? What's that's worth, you know. But, you know, I was 18 or 19 years old sitting on a bar stool reflecting on how the hell I got so screwed up and what was the matter with me and why life wasn't even worth living at 19, you know, and I come up with the reasons then that stuck with me until Alcoholics Anonymous literally beat them out of me, you know, these ideas I had. And I thought that the reason I was such a screwball and having so much trouble with everything was that I had a rotten home life. And it seemed to me everybody else had just great home life, you know. And mine was bad. And I had a working mother, and I had a father who was a professional bridegroom. He was married 5 times, you know. And I had a grandmother to raise me that helped me with my self-centeredness by coming out in the street with me and my friends and waddling out there and blowing her nose on her apron and all kinds of things. And I was embarrassed, and I was just so full of me when I was so young, I didn't know what that was about, you know. And one of the things that tricked me about life was that I had such a hard time was that I thought I could do something about everything that bothered me. You know, I couldn't just let something, you know, people would stand there and let something bother them. They'd say, "It's bothering me." I couldn't stand that. I said, I'm leaving. Or I'm going to holler, or I'm going to get drunk over it, or I'm going to do something. I just couldn't say, "Yeah, this is bothering me too." I had this self inside me that even when I was good, I couldn't stand it. You know, I mean, I could be good. Oh, I could be so good it just gag you. You know? But I can't be good too long because I'm not naturally good. You know? And I think there's people that have just a good streak in them or something. I lean towards the bad streak, you know. And so I was self-conscious. I had a rotten time. And when I was 8 or 9 years old, my mother remarried. And I got me a stepfather that was like Frank, you know. And he sort of made a hobby knocking the hell out of me, you know. And I sort of made like an avocation out of deserving it, you know. But I didn't realize that. I didn't know. You know, it just seemed to me like Clancy said, so he's always saying something cute, you know, if you hang around him a little bit, it just makes it so good, you know. That's why he has that entourage or whatever. But he told me, I was complaining about being too fat. And he said, no problem with that. Just go on a diet where what you do is, if it tastes good, spit it out. You know. Gives you, you know, along with some good advice and friendly criticism, you get good, wholesome help in how to live your life. And he's got spies up at Pittsburgh that'll, you know, get all the notes and everything about this and continue to research my case up there. And that's probably good. And I was just having all kinds of trouble. And I didn't do well in school. I don't know what the hell. I'm afraid to investigate to this day what the hell's the matter with me. I'm sure I got all kinds of stuff wrong with me that makes me excel in some things that aren't important and don't know what the hell I'm doing with stuff that seems important. And I thought in school I just hated stuff so bad. I wasn't motivated and I didn't even know what that word meant to him. I just couldn't get it going. I just couldn't get glad about the stuff that they wanted me to. And I ended up getting in all kinds of trouble. I liked girls and stuff like that. And I hated authority. They just wanted me to do everything awful and not do anything that was fun. I remember there was a little kid in the cloakroom. You know, I said, get out of the cloakroom. There's girls in the cloakroom. I said, that's why I'm in the cloakroom. Couldn't understand why they separated girls and boys all the time when I thought girls were just so nice and soft and cuddly and everything. You know, they were just so cute, you know. Boy, I'll tell you what. I've discovered girls when I was in third grade. That's a long haul waiting to get some action. Sometimes you go too fast and you make mistakes. But I ended up, I was like in a regular high school, whatever that was. The kind you'd picture that Ricky Nelson would have went to, you know. The show Ricky Nelson, not the real Ricky Nelson. But I got thrown out of there for doing things. You know, I was forging library passes and selling them and selling dirty pictures. You could see the same dirty pictures on Home Box today. I was 30 years ahead of my time. So they put me in a school in the worst section of Pittsburgh, in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, a vocational school. That's a funny thing. They take all the problem students and they put them in a trade school where you really have to think. You got to know math and everything else to be a goddamn plumber. I didn't know that, you know. And the people go on to Notre Dame and everything and end up just promoting things or something, you know. You talk about how AA gives people humility. I got a friend in my group. He got sober a few years ago, and he was a graduate of Notre Dame. And he gets up and leads, and he says he thinks of Notre Dame like Conley Vocational High School that Jack talks about. And I said, Jesus. God, he was a real, I mean, it was the place, man. All the kids down there today were incorrigible. Like it was sort of like a place where you could go on ahead into reform school or prison. You know? Every problem child in Allegheny County ended up down there just before they got thrown out altogether. And they had teachers down there that could manage us. You know, that was mostly their job, these big gorillas. And they managed pretty good. You know, we didn't manage very good, but they did. But I was into all this stuff and deathly afraid of my stepfather and self-conscious and just no direction and just goofy, a goofy kid. And I ended up I forged my report card. The ink ran. I knew the old man was going to kill me. I'm waiting for him to come home from work. Pacing the house, and somebody else mentioned that slow gin. Slow gin in the icebox. I found the slow gin, and I drank it. And when it was like 25 years later that an expression came out, I guess in the late 60s, that I couldn't think of then. But if I could have thought of it, it's what I would have said. The slow gin went down. And I would have said, all right. Jesus, everything that was, all that crap, that self-centeredness, that inability to fit in, feeling of fear and alienation from everybody, and that restless, irritable discontent, and that went away. And this was like medicine. This fixed that. And I told you I was the kind of guy who wanted to fix it. whatever it is, do something about it. Don't just stand there, man, I feel rotten, you know. So I decided, I don't know if I consciously decided, but I just, I was going to drink that. Because that worked. That did it. And you know, the funny thing about alcohol is, for a guy like me, you do get better about things for a while. You know, it's better when I was, you know, I was so hurting towards the tail end of my drinking. I could identify, I remember reading a book called Never Promised a Rose Garden, and I remember it talked about insanity in there. And I understood insanity, except I couldn't get the good part about insanity. You know, I could identify with a person that thought they were Napoleon. You know, I would be the last good stage of it, where the pain stopped. Why, yes, I'm Napoleon. Chop your goddamn heads off if you bother me, you know? And he could believe that about himself, and you're excused from all the crap. Me, I was always me, and just on the threshold of going mad. And I wasn't mad. Well, I was mad, but I wasn't insane. And the worst of it is, when I took the only thing that helped me, alcohol, I got insane. As far as everybody else concerned, I was happy as hell, drunk. As soon as I drank that stuff and realized how much I liked it and how much it did for me, I intuitively knew that they wouldn't want me to drink it. Because they didn't want me to do anything and help me, you know. Now, you know, that chips on your shoulder if you're a young man like me then, and I just knew it. And I, you know, when I came in AA, and they talked about honesty so much in here, when I was new, I'll be damned if I could understand that. It's tough today because I'm telling you, if you're going to drink, if you drink, you can't be honest. Let me give you an example. I can visualize me drinking, and I've been drinking, and a cop stops me and says, "Have you been drinking?" Oh, yeah. I've been drinking for a week now. Got some in the back seat, you know? Or go down to finance company, and they say, "Why do you want to borrow this money?" Don't lie. I could tell them something like I really had problems where I had to go to them, and these problems would be, "Well, yes, I went on an extensive drunk, and I spent 2 weeks running. I spent my whole pay. I put $150 in a stinking pinball machine. How about $500, you know?" That ain't what you tell them. You tell a guy out of finance company, "So I need $500. I want to buy a new iron lung for my mother." So, if you're like me, when you get here, you lie. And it makes perfectly good sense to lie. And then you come in here and they want to turn it all around. You know, they want you to tell the truth. And it's just tough. You like, you got momentum on this lie. You know? That's why another one of them Fink Eleanor said about our lips move and we're lying, you know. We're always doing it. It's a damn shame they get together, they talk, and they learn, you know. You know, up our way, a lot of guys have sort of settled down taking shots at Eleanor because I tell you what, they devised some kind of a way to, they get us. I know how they do it, but there seems like they have like a secret call or something. And I'll be making these funny little witticisms about Alan Odds, you know, and then three of them will appear, you know. And they get it all out of context, you know. But, you know, I'm 17 years old. I married a girl. I got her here tonight. I'm pushing her out of a wheelchair because she got a torn ligament in her leg, you know. And thank God that's not a real serious thing to me because she'll be over it pretty soon and able to help back with the work again. But that just, you know, it ain't cool pushing a wheelchair all over the place, you know. It's a little fun once in a while you run into somebody's shins or something. But she's going to be all right. But I married this girl. I was 17 years old. That shows you how bright I am. You got a real bright fella up here. But I married a good woman, and that's probably the worst thing can happen to an alcoholic like me. It's really tough to be married to a good woman. And I couldn't appreciate it. And I got drunk over not being able to appreciate things. Somebody say, you don't do right. How the hell can you sit down here and drink? And I met your wife. She's a nice woman. And that little girl of yours, my God. How could you, a person like you, sit here and drink? Well, that's another day tack on with that. And I knew it, too. I knew it was coming. I knew that that would make me drink, and I hated that about me, and I hated you for pushing that button that got that going. And I thought that maybe, you know, I could get all these little tidbits together that was just making me nuts and find some kind of a pattern or something I could get my fingers on and stop it somehow. You know, and I just couldn't. I just didn't know what to do. I just drank. And there was occasions I didn't drink. I mean, I didn't drink every day. I wanted to. I drank as much as I could, and I sort of like let go and let other outside forces control my drinking a little bit. Like, I wouldn't drink right at work, right in front of the boss. And I couldn't, a lot of times I couldn't drink at home. And I would go back and forth. Like, I'd drink at lunchtime at work or drink in the morning, until I got in so much heat at work and so much trouble that I'd like quit drinking when it interfered with work. And as soon as work was over, I'd go get drunk, and then I'd get trouble at home. But I like had to get drunk, and I didn't know when to do it. Nobody would give me some kind of a schedule or something, you know? And once in a while, I just got it all going, and I was just drinking all the time, and I had her hollering and the boss hollering. It was like a chorus out there going, jumping all over me, and I felt it awful. And then I'd just be so drunk, and then I'd go on one of them good binges. I used to always get drunk on payday. See? Now, Reader's Digest probably would call a fella like me a blue-collar problem drinker. And blue-collar problem drinkers get drunk on payday, or there's something wrong with their alcoholism. It's just as simple as that. And I got paid on Thursdays, and I got drunk on Thursday. And then everybody needs to get drunk Friday. You got to go out to them roadhouses where they're boogieing and have a good time. Rock and roll, you know. And I was there when rock and roll was brand new, you know. And the fellas that like it, they ain't changed too damn much, neither. And now, you know, we used to comb our hair back on the side. Some other speaker mentioned that, and you don't comb it in the middle. And that's why mine fell out, I think. I don't know what the hell's going to happen to these poor Bobby Browners with the flat top or the ones with the orange thing sticking up. They'll probably grow little clumps on their hind end or something. Huh? You don't have to worry. Don't cut it off. Soon fall off. You know what I mean? And so I was trying to do something about his drinking while I was drinking. And towards like my late 20s, I got a real serious campaign to do something about what was wrong with me. Because I had searched for everything. I searched for a higher power. And the only one I could find was Beneficial Finance. And they let me down. And my wife was on some other kind of campaign to do something about me. And that wasn't working real good. And I started to tell you about this payday thing, and I got sidetracked here. But I'd get drunk on Friday, Saturday, or Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and I'd come to on Sunday somewhere. And most of the time was at home, and most of the time was my wife getting me out of bed. My wife had a dust mop, give you ballast in the back, and she'd stick it in me and grind it like, you know. And I'd wake up with this. And I wanted to kill her, but I didn't have the strength. She knew when to get me, you know. And sometimes her timing was bad. And in that case, I'd chase her and bust furniture and all kinds of crap and make everybody crazy. And the neighbors, quiet down over there. Up go the wind. I'll kill you too, you know. Drug a hose through my house one time and scored a neighbor outside that was laying on the yard. Damn, my wife got in a fight and the hose got loose in my kitchen. All kinds of stuff like that. Set punch holes in the wall, and I got a little jigsaw somewhere, and I made all these little oak leaf things, and I put them over the holes, and we sold the house. Thank God that guy who bought the house was a drunk, too, you know. He didn't. I used to get hide stuff in there, you know. Lift every one of them up. Just random, you know. And I remember him saying, well, why would you put one here? You know, that's not... It's belly button level. That's one of them little short jabs, you know? And she'd get me up out of bed, and she would say, let's go. And I can't imagine where. And my little daughter's in the corner, and I swore my wife staged her crying to be a tear in my daughter's eye. And I'm trying to tell myself, I didn't cause this. I've been in bed. And I was just getting so cynical. I thought maybe my wife took an eyedropper. I said, put a little tear on there for you so you make that stinking father of yours shape up. And she'd tell me, we're going to the zoo. That's where we're going. I said, you got to be kidding me. Well, you've been drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Don't know what time you got home Saturday night, but she got you up with that dust mop. And you got to go to the zoo. Man, I'll tell you. And, you know, I had a car. My car was hopefully outside. You know, and I didn't know. I had a blue-collar problem drinker's car. I had four different size tires on it. Windshield wipers don't work on my side, you know. And the seats broke and the glove compartment sprung. That's so you can see them traffic tickets that are laying in there. It's like a reminder to pay them, you know. Yeah, you know, it used to get me when I was in my drinking. I just couldn't understand them. I'd overhear them talk. I was like never included, but they would talk. I mean, people with jobs and just regular people. And they would say, yes, George, I got a set of those radial tires the other day. You were brand new then, you know. What the hell's radial tire? You know, I mean, I got mine with Donna Junkyard, so you got something without a bubble. I got a bubble. I didn't understand it. And that's the kind of car I had, and you know, maybe my plates were bad, they weren't paid for, or my driver's license is suspended, or I didn't pay, you know, just didn't pay, don't have it, don't have a license. I didn't have $2, or whatever the hell it was, and I spent it. And people wouldn't understand that, and I hated to talk to people and ask you, why, what do you mean you don't have a driver, didn't you ever take a test? I have a goddamn driver's license, it's just that I didn't send it in, that's all. Well, why wouldn't you send it in? You know, and I want to get them by the throat. Pretty soon they could tell. Your eyes are fiery red, man, and your neck's sticking out. They'll say, hey, okay, forget about the driver. Except cops. They push and push. You know. And you know who's going to win that, so, you know. And so anyhow, my wife would get me down at the zoo. I had to check that car out before I, you know, before she got out to it. I don't know what's in it. I don't know who's in it. I remember being so upset. My wife was like Sherlock Holmes. I don't know what yours was like. She could find anything. My wife could tell you the color of an earring in our room from here. Look it up there, you know. Look at that. There's an earring laying over. What the hell? I don't know what the hell happened with everything I did. And she would find them damn receipts from the finance company. They'd give you about 50 copies of everything when you go in there, you know. Christ, I'm throwing papers out the window and everything on the way back from... And there's one under the seat, you know. So I remember trying to stop that business, and I come home 3 o'clock in the morning one night, and I said to myself, she is not going to find anything in this car that she misunderstands this time. And I stopped that car, and I went from one end to the other. I took the seats out of the back, set the seats on a sidewalk, and I tore that, and there was nothing in that car to bother that damn woman. I knew it. And I went home, and I went to bed. And the next morning, she woke me up, and she said, I want to ask you a question. Man, I hate questions. She says, why is the back seat of our car down 3 houses? Oh, man. So this same little darling has me up the zoo now. And she, and look at me, this is what I thought. Now, I don't know whether this would happen, but it seemed to me she would manipulate me around as though I stood directly in front of them stinking hippopotamuses. And they would get, like, behind me until, like, the gate was pushing on my nose. And I'm standing there as this waves of stench from that wretched beast just coming over. And I've been drinking for 4 days, and I am real sick. And I don't want to be here, and I don't like the kind of people who are there. Everybody, you know, oh, hey, look at the giraffe over here, you know. That damn guys that wear them baseball hats with the PK on straight, goddamn. You know, wear one of them stupid hats, put the hat on straight. You know, I'll tell you, you want to know how to put them hats on, you watch them Nazi movies. They're the ones that wear them hats. And they tuck it down a little bit on the top. That's the way to wear them, not sideways, you know. But they'd all be out. Now, everybody in the family loved them kind of guys. That guy would be Uncle somebody or something. And he looked to me like he acted as goofy as I do when I'm drinking. But he don't drink, you know. And everybody, hey, Uncle Charlie and all them. And all the kids with suckers and sticky stuff all come around me for some reason. Bossy. And I'm sick, and you touch them, you stick to these kids. And they scream behind your back, and that. You're standing in the zoo, and I'm just marking time. I don't want to be here. I'm here as part of the package of punishment to get it over with. And my wife is standing there snarling. And a family of them would come right up beside us, like as if God sent them down and say, now see, Jack, now there, here's the way it ought to be. Now this guy would have a nice sport jacket on, you know, a little gray in his temples and steel gray eyes, and he'd stand there with this lovely, attractive lady, you know, arm in arm, you know, and she'd look up into his eyes adoringly, you know, and he'd look over at her and smile knowingly and all that, you know. And they got a little boy or a little girl, and they'd scamper off, you know, and he'd say, Johnny, and the kid would stop in his tracks, turn around, and say, yes, Dad. He'd say, come back here, son. And when the kid would come back, he'd spar, you know, and fool around. And the mother, you know, the mother would, you'd hear overhear little things. She'd say, that's my man, my big man and my little man. And there I stand, it's the summertime, I got a flannel shirt on, a spot and raw. You know, I got two different kind of socks on or something. I got this snarling shrew of a wife standing beside me looking at me. I got a little girl that's from an alcoholic home, she's a nervous wreck, she don't know whether her mommy's going to go into some kind of a raging tirade, or whether her father's going to just start drinking and mothering everybody, you know. General, what's going to happen here? And she's like, yes, we're supposed to be having a good time at the zoo. You know? And only I know, I seem to be the only one in the world that knows that it would be better on a Sunday afternoon at the VFW. You know? I mean, why this? We could be down there playing a jukebox. A little girl could be eating them cholesterol-filled potato chips. And we could be dancing a little bit, rubbing a little bit of bellies. You know, maybe go home when the kids are asleep, you know. That's in my mind. And her mind is another down that club with the car getting wrecked on the way home, you know, and him coming to the house and busting furniture again. And seems like all our little terrible fantasies come true, you know. She would get her way in that I would do that. I would break the furniture up with the zoo. It didn't even help, you know. She started coming to the bar, but the rage came from the zoo. Or I would take 10 minutes out of my zoo time to make sure that drinking was the reason that the fiasco come about, you know. But my wife and I had this same argument over and over again. The same screaming and hollering. I remember telling her, it just seemed like I was so sensitive to things that even drunk I could understand what was going on here. She didn't. I said, don't you see, it's like a script. I come in the house, you say, where in the hell have you been? You know? And I turn around and I say, I don't give a damn what you think. I don't care where I've been. It don't matter all that much. And she would say, well, how can you drink when the bills ain't paid, the neighbors are mad, the police called here, your buddy, there's a guy threatened to kill you. There's this, there's that, and I say, that, you're asking me
one question, isn't that redundant? That's why I drink. You're telling me why I shouldn't drink, and that's exactly the reason I should drink. We had misunderstandings. And it wasn't working. I started to say before the zoo story about this trying to fix myself. Here I am, I'm a budding pipe fitter plumber, and I want to read all these self-improvement books. You really want to get squirrely. Take a new direction in the way that, you know, your guys with my job should read Sports Illustrated, drink beer, and shut up, you know. Not me. I'm reading Eric Fromm. He's my hero. I read all the 60s guys, all the books that A.B. Hoffman wrote, you know, Steal This Book and Revolution for the Hell of It and all that. Timothy Leary, so I could justify everything, you know. Oh, if it's fun, do it. You'll love it, you know. And it made me, and Marcus Desaad, if you really want to get tacky, he said, oh, I ain't that bad, you know. And I'd share a lot of this with my wife, who would just stand there catatonic and look at me. The more I read, the more I would quote Socrates. And my friends would say, what the hell are you talking about, you goddamn jerk? You know? And they'd say things to me that would really hurt me. They say, oh, you know, some of a bitch talks about them philosophers, whatever the hell they are. He put that goddamn water heater in, it was out of level. I don't know. I tell him, you don't understand. There was no shims in the truck, and I didn't want to call back and be embarrassed as an ass, and I didn't pick him up before I left, you know. Ah, bullshit. You're just too goddamn miserable. And I just thought, you know, this world ain't right. You know, I mean, I just don't fit in here good. And I, the only one I could blame for all that would be God. Then the ministers come around and tell me, you must pray to God. You know, go worshipfully. Worship? I'm mad as hell. I ain't worshiping nothing. I want to go fight with God. How can I do that? Everybody said, he said, fight with God. My God. Won't be long now. It's a rubber room for him. You know? Next thing would be sewing the American flag on his ass or something. You know? And if I was drunk enough, I'd say, what the hell's the matter with that? You know? Oh, boy, they have all the patriots up in arms and everything. Not only the matriarchs, but the patriots. Always had the matriarchs up in arms. I remember coming home and they'd sit on their porch. Look at me. Hey, you know, I'm home. Jesus, I'm such a wreck. And I, you know, the worst of it is I knew it. Yeah, I knew all that. I knew everything was wrong with me. That wasn't the point. Nobody understood that there was nothing you could do about that. Because I took all this information about myself that I was told by other people, told by the clergy, told by respected people, told by enemies of mine, people I liked, everything else seemed to be the same consensus about me. And I took all that information to heart and sat down and thought about it, and the end result was this squirrel cage of mental gymnastics. There was just no way out of that mess. There just was no way. And the only relief I got was drinking. And towards the end, why, the drinking had absolutely no value because it didn't work. It just made it worse automatically. And that's a real point of desperation. And I ended up with the worst thing I could possibly think of at the time. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't think of nothing worse. I couldn't. If I could just die, I'd have been a lot happier in the beginning. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous in January 1969, and I didn't get sober until April 1970, so that I have to account for 14 or 15 months there. And my home group referred to me in those days as Jack the Slipper. Now, I was so mad at people that said anything about that for a while, because I was trying. You know, I hated to be likened with the people who said, oh, hell with AA, I'm going to go get drunk. You know, I didn't do that. I come to meetings and I read the book and I'd done everything. And then when I got drunk, people would tell me, you ain't got the first step. I had the first step drunk in a bar. The first step made me drunk. What do you think of that? Because I'm powerless over, if you're powerless over alcohol, you're going to drink, damn it. So staying sober 3 or 4 months was really good for a guy like me because I was Passover alcohol. And I thought that sobriety was what I thought it was. My perception of sobriety was not drinking. That's all I ever knew about sobriety. You don't drink. And it seems so god-awful important in Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't drink. It seemed to sidetrack my grave problems that I wanted to talk of all the time. Everybody just got real stuff, you know. And everything I said in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while was wrong. You know, you just like hear a chorus of that. Wrong. You know. But wrong. You know. And, you know, today, I see a lot of people celebrate old-timers. You know, it's real popular to get a guy 30 years sober or something and, one for those old timers, you know. And I love old timers. I'd like to be one someday. But the old timers ain't the ones that help guys like me. And the reason I want to say that is for 2 reasons. I want to remember it. And I want to tell those people that felt like I felt when I was sober a year or so. I used to feel every once in a while that I was of no value. That hell, I don't really have nothing. Things ain't all that much better and all that crap would come through my head and I'd get crazy. But I'm going to tell you something. So the people who were sober a year, 18 months, people like that are the ones that saved me. Because the old-timers, I'd say something to the old-timers, they'd hear me out, and they'd say, "Why, yes, easy does it. See you Monday." Those guys sober a year or something were just crazy. And they'd say, "You're getting a goddamn car. We'll go. We're going down to Oakmont or something to a meeting." "All right, Chris, why not go? We're going where I say to go. I'm driving, ain't I?" You know, and there'd be 5 or 6 guys in that car, every one of them just stone crazy. All of them sober 6 months, 8 months, a year and a half. We had an old timer in there sober 19 months or something, you know. And he wasn't even driving. He had his pigeon who was sober a week driving. You're all in that car together, and now the conversations that I perceived in there, I mean, I don't know if they really went on, but it seemed to me there would be conversations like, "I'm telling you, Jim, if Margaret don't come back, goddamn, if I can't get that woman back, I ain't going to make it." And the guy in the back said, "Holy shit, Jim, if I don't get rid of that bitch I'm living with." The guy said, "I can't stand my job." The other guy said, "If I had a job like you..." And all that just madness, and pretty soon to have everybody in the car laughing. Because it was just crazy. And by having them those contradictions just bouncing around in a little old Chevy or something, you just say to yourself, the only way out of this madness is to let go. You know, one by one, the guys just let go. They say to you, "What do you think?" "I don't know, I let go." But you know, that second step, I was never able to do the steps, the first few steps that people talk about. I was able to take my inventory, and I was able to go march down and tell somebody. Of course, I wanted to find somebody who was real old and sick. Tell them, you know. And I didn't want to tell nobody about that stuff I was ashamed of. You know, and they tell you to tell the worst thing first, like get it over with, and then go on the other stuff. Well, the other stuff ain't enough. You're flying once you get, you know, accept your thing. And what if that son of a bitch will call the cops or something? But I couldn't, like, do steps. Have you done the third step? How do you do the third step? I had problems. That second step just confounded me because I didn't hear it right. You know, it says, you know, we have contempt prior to investigation, many of us. And so I didn't hear that second step. They said it meeting after meeting. They said the step. Everybody read it. I read it. I looked at it. I underlined it. I knew all about it, but I didn't. That's not what I heard. They said, "We came to believe that a power greater than self could restore us to sanity." That's not what I heard. What I heard was, "Do you finally believe in everything it says in the Apostles' Creed at that little Methodist church? You believe that God was crucified, dead, and buried, you know? You believe that he went straight up to heaven, not like the Catholics, he went down, then up.
And those Hebrews that think he didn't even come, let alone go. And those other strange third world countries where they think he went and come back as a dove or something. You know? Millions of people believe in just crazy different stuff that was completely contradictory. And just stand there and say, I believe, I'm getting it, I believe. You know? I used to, like, put a cap on this, I believe I am a cynical son of a bitch. Is what. And damn, my age is saying, oh, you're starting to believe something. A willingness, you know. God, they had an answer for everything. But you know, one day I wasn't sitting in some little chapel with stained glass window with the sun shining through. I'm sitting on a toilet. And it dawned on me that by doing the things that they wanted me to do, you know, they told me, go to meetings. If you can't do anything, go to meetings. You can't work them steps if you don't know nothing about God or you don't want to know. You know, people would throw things in. Well, one guy's lecturing you, saying, if you can't do this, you can't. Yeah, he don't want to know. You know, you get these little tidbits from the side. And you don't really have time to attack a guy properly. You have to defend the main force here coming from. God, I was just such a big job, you know, going through all this. But that step, like, just got, I thought to myself, I believe that this nutty setup here is going to fix me. I don't know what it was, but I believe that it was going to work. You know, I believe that it was going to restore me to sanity. My opinion of sanity, I'm sure, was insanity was right then. I knew that my insanity was drinking. Because when I drank, I got to Napoleon. You know, if I didn't drink, I wasn't him. You know, and I had a standard hurt. When I got drunk, I could be him or anybody. Oh, I don't want you to think I went around acting like Napoleon. Jesus. I didn't know. And I went around acting like Hitler, more like. But it just happened to me. And once it happened to me, I wanted to sign up, or whatever you want to call it. I wanted that third step. I wanted to turn this problem, me, this big thing that was killing me, over to something else, over to you, to this AA program, to whatever they call it here. And it got to be so that I wasn't so sensitive about hearing God. I studied that big book and I seen things in there that happened to other alcoholics. Founders, it happened to people in the first 100. It was important to me to know that. When I talked to in AA literature about it, we bristled with antagonism at the mere mention of organized religion. Jesus, I love those people who wrote that so long ago. Because it was me. Chapter to the agnostics. There ain't no chapter to the sports fans in there. That book is talking right to people like you and I that have this damn problem, this living problem, that for a while alcohol seems to fix and then alcohol gives in and then we stand at that turning point. You know, we don't know what to do. We got to make a decision. We got to go one way or the other. And they give me these steps to work. They give me everything in this program. It took me 4 or 5 years to make amends to my family, to my satisfaction. You might ask my wife tonight, is he through with his amends? She might say, oh, no. I don't know what she says. I'm sure she wouldn't say that. She'd say, he makes the 10th step when needed, you know. And I had a hard time with that. There were speakers up here this weekend. Up to now, I was loaded with dynamite speakers. And I just went after another. I'm saying, Jesus, I hate to go up there. Can't take it. These people were just such high-powered leads, such high-powered talks. And people filled with enthusiasm. The audience, and the people that came to the meeting, the other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, their enthusiasm at this particular conference. Extraordinary. Great. Just great. Made my weekend, I know that. Made me feel better. Made me think. Some of the other speakers talked about things that I needed to hear. One of the speakers mentioned that always happens, you know. That you go to a meeting, it seems like they're all talking about the damn thing you don't want to deal with, you know. It's just uncanny. It makes believers out of them stinking agnostics, you know. And if you're like me, you try to drift back to it once in a while when it interferes with making some money or something, you know. And Like there's no escape for a guy like me but to do what I have to do. And it surprises me how much I kick and scream before I do it. Because I'm like, oh, I'm almost 51 years old. And you'd think I'd learn. I've been in AA since 1970. But I got to fight a little bit first, you know, before I do anything. You know, I got to do it. But you know, I had to make amends. And you know, one of the things I'm going to bring up, and then I'm going to close, but I want to talk about it. Because I think it was the most important thing in my life. I was sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I was the kind of guy that I made some judgments about whether the speaker was good or not when I was new. I didn't go spread it around. I didn't say, he's no good. You know, I didn't do that. I'm afraid to say, you're the one that's no damn good. You know, and I don't want to hear that, so I just sit there and look. And I remember one speaker, I was just sitting, I was thinking about when I went home, whether I was going to kill her or kill myself or start drinking again or whatever. Just everything was just coming in on me. And I didn't like the speaker. Now, the speaker that night was a well-respected long-timer around our area. And all I got out of his lead was that he got sober to improve his golf score. That's what I got. And I didn't even like golfers. And this guy had a lot of money, and he was a professional man and all that. And I just, I was so full of resentments because, you know, I blamed everything on my stepfather. And I blamed my alcoholism on him for a while. And he had his own. You know, he got issued separate cases there. I don't know why the hell I blame him. And but I was just so full of rage and resentment and sitting there and hurting and that gut still hurting and in AA a while and I was just crazy. And somebody come up to me and prodded me, not AA's will prod you to get it out. Come on, you know, squeezing a boil or something, you know. They said, I'm sorry. So it's plumbers, you know. And a guy said to me, how'd you like the speaker? And I said, I didn't like him. You know? And man, I got, why didn't you like him? And I start telling him, man, I got this big crowd around me, you know. And they got like chairs and sit down. I'm in the middle. And I'm finally opening up. I'm almost the verge of tears. And I'm just bad. I just felt like I had a whip in a chair. And these were all lions coming. And finally, like, they just overwhelmed me because it was obvious that they weren't the same as them. They weren't the way people attacked me, like when I was doing wrong, when I was drinking. These people, you could see the love and the understanding in their eyes. You know, maybe that sounds a little corny, but I could like feel it. It was almost tangible. And they just loved me. They just loved me a bunch. And they started talking to me about themselves. And I started finding out about guys that did prison time, and they were sodomized in there, and they're living with it, and blah, 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 and heavy stuff. It wasn't about, I quit drinking and everything's wonderful now. It wasn't about that then. It was about sharing the deep stuff. And they told me that I had to go make amends to that stepfather. You know, I wanted him to come to me. And I had to go to him. And I went away, I didn't know what to do. Because I like it, had this hobby of hating him. And I didn't know what to do, but it just kept coming. You know how stuff creeps up on you when AA, if you don't move on it, if you don't move on, take the action, it just keeps starting to crowd you, pushes the other fun out of your life. The things that were working ain't working even now, you know. And I knew I had to do that. So I made arrangements to go out and see him. He lived in Chicago, and I lived in Pittsburgh. And I went out. And I got him sitting at the kitchen table, and I started to talk to him. Now, before I went, the AAs told me, take some of your own inventory when you go out there to talk with him. Don't go out there and get in big trouble with him. And I thought, well, shit, I really could probably get up enough money to have a hit put on that son of a bitch. And maybe all that would go away. And I said, no, that won't go away. So I got out there. And I sit down at the kitchen table with him. I told him I wanted to talk to him. And I had taken this inventory of myself. And I come up with some things. When I was a little kid, when I was 8 or 9 years old, I would not take his name. He wanted to change my name. He wanted to make me his son and be responsible for raising this little brat. I wouldn't let him. I wouldn't give him that. And that was such a cross to bear anyhow. A name like Jack Dempsey was a son of a bitch of a name back in the 50s. And guys would punch me just to say they hit Jack Dempsey. And I had to hang on to that because I wouldn't give that stepfather. I wouldn't, you know, I just wouldn't do that. And I hung on to that, and he was a proud man and a drinker, and you know how that sets with somebody like that. And, Jesus, I knew I'd done wrong by him by that, and I put that number one on what I was going to talk to him about. The second thing was that I was a sniveling little mummy's boy in order to try to woo my mother out of the circumstances. You don't need that gorilla. You know, you don't need that, who needs a cement block with hair on it running around the house? Hey, them girls like them cement blocks with hair on them. And so anyhow, I sat down at the table and I told him how I badmouthed him sitting at bars, talked about what a rotten creep he was, and I said I got sober in this Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm talking in Leeds. I'm badmouthing in Leeds. I said, it's been bothering me because I know I'm wrong about a lot of things. I know you put food on the table, and I know you taught me how to do things. You made a mechanic out of me. I know that, you know, we're all shoveling cement and fixing things and working hard, and that did me some good. You give me a work ethic, and I'm able to put bread on the table. And I respect you for that. And I talked to him about all this stuff. And he said, hey, what are you worried about? No problem. He said, that was a long time ago. That's when you were a kid. He said, now you're in that A&A or whatever the hell you call it, and you're doing fine. As a matter of fact, you ain't coming out here and didn't even know you come. You remember that? And, I didn't, but I said, yeah. And he said, your wife's not writing letters or calling your mother anymore with these god-awful gloomy reports and scary stories and everything. She quit doing that since you got in that A&A or whatever it is. He says, as a matter of fact, I want to tell you, boy, he says, I'm proud of you. I thought, damn, he must have heard some of the good work, you know, I've been doing in A.A. And he said, I'm going to tell you why I'm proud of you. I said, oh, boy, here it comes. You know, he had never said that. He was proud of me. And he said, I'm proud of you because I made you what you are today. The first thing jumped in my mind was, this ain't the way that's supposed to work. But, you know, it made me laugh. Just like you did, it made me laugh. Because I realized the powerlessness of it. And I realized that he was a different entity than what I'd conceived. He had his opinion of me. You know, God rest his soul. He thought that worked. And I give him more by shutting up about that than I could have if I made good amends to him. He knocked the hell out of me when I was a little kid. He'd done a lot of things wrong. But I just carried that for years and years and years. And the poor guy worked hard, didn't get no credit, got hollered at, got arrested for drinking. The same thing that happens to all of us. Went around with crap in his pants once in a while and trying to clean up and salvage some kind of dignity. And there he had this goofy stepson that wouldn't do nothing for him. And he'd give me that. He'd give me all he could give me. He'd give me that I was finally a man like him. You know, finally got a house and a car and working every day. You're taking that overtime, ain't you? You know? And I became what he thought. And he said, and I knew that he would tell other guys, hey, I'm a boy who used to drink air, but he quit. Quit, Anna, so he quit. What are you doing about yours? And I walked away from then, that man, and I never had that ball of hate inside my gut about him again. If I wouldn't have took that action that they absolutely made me take in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have never got over it. I know I would have never got over that. And eventually that resentment and that hate would have hurt too bad. And I know me. I know if I'd have got it in conjunction with something else going sour in my life, that I'd have put a case together so I could go pick up a case. You know what I mean? And I'm glad that I did that, looking back on it. Looking back on every painful thing they made me do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am glad I did it. I am glad that I stayed up all night, drank too much coffee, and smoked too many cigarettes, talking to other alcoholics about this damn disease. I'm glad that I went to these conferences. I'm glad that I was there to see my daughter graduate with honors from high school and win a scholarship at Pitt University. I was glad when she aced them down at Pitt, and she went and got a scholarship and a fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. I was glad I was there to take her down and help her move. I was glad that she picked a house and she didn't know it. She picked an apartment that was right across the street from the biggest AA clubhouse in St. Louis. You tell me there's no higher power, you know? I'm up there hanging, you know how you get with the two women. I got the daughter and the wife. I'll say, put that picture over there, put this here. You know, and I'm going around putting these things up. And then I could, you know, say, just a minute. And I wasn't allowed to smoke in there either. My daughter don't smoke, and she's just fanatical about not smoking. There's a cigarette in the world. And so I'd run over that AA clubhouse over there, and I'd not have a cigarette and a cup of coffee and sit down with one of my AAs, and then I'd get back, restored. And you know, I have a 32-year-old daughter that got bad sick back in 84. She was the one that went through all my drinking. You know? I mean, she was right there when I, and holding on to my leg to try to keep me from going out or trying to keep me from attacking her mother. And God Almighty, she went through so much, you know. And that little girl got sick in 1984. She was bad sick. You know, AA's come through. Man, I'll tell you, I was at that hospital. And I just come to meetings, and I was like a zombie. And you know, and they come into my life. And all the sickness, and my wife had some sickness, and all that stuff, you know, shit happens, man. And, but if it wasn't for the strength, I wouldn't have the richness of life that makes it worth going through, because we're going to go through it. You know, you can't get out of this world alive. And shit happens, and I would have never been able to enjoy the rest, because I had that tendency to contaminate anything that was good or healthy for me with all the other junk. Yeah, but, you know, if I hit the lottery, I say, yeah, but, you know. And so Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me. That's the main thing. This program, my high power, and a little help from his little helpers, like my sponsor and them other rats. People with just sort of a nasty streak inherent in them were put in front of me to block any easier, softer way that might yet be out there. And they fixed me. Or they made a new me or something that's able, that I'm able today, to just live life and not get drunk about it. Not get everything pulled down with me. Oh, I'm going to have a bad day. Maybe pull, how about you killing yourself? You know, I don't have to do that. And I'm so grateful for that. Is such a big thing to me that it still has a magic for me. You know, isn't that a funny thing? It still has a magic because it's such a big thing. I'm grateful that I'm in a place, Alcoholics Anonymous, where I can pull that bunny out of the hat like when I need it. Seems like other people, they got to take life as like hitting them. I say, boy, that was a rough one. You know, and they're just plowing through there and they don't have that. They don't have this. Can you imagine how much joy it puts in a person's heart to realize that I took a weekend, a little weekend, and I left the shop on Thursday. Everybody else said, well, I don't know what you're going to do Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They're going bowling, they're going here, you know. Going out a little country band down there, I'm going to check them out. And I'm going to Omaha, Nebraska. I wouldn't have no idea. If I said, I could just picture that shop. Yeah, I'm going to Omaha, Nebraska. What? You know, I could have won money. So I'll pay you $50, he ain't going to Omaha, Nebraska. What the hell plumber takes 3 days off work and leaves Pittsburgh? Pittsburgh's the same anyhow. You know? If you pick somebody up out of the center of Omaha, stuck him down at Grand Street in Pittsburgh, say, now open your eyes, well, what happened? You know? So it's like Omaha, Nebraska, Wood Hills. You know? I want to thank Scott for introducing me up here, his committee having me down here. And God love you people for having my wife and I down here. Have a nice day.